Welcome to Positive Personal Power with hope, aspiration, and encouragement. Our goal is to build and enhance people's confidence and strength to handle life's challenges. Now, let me introduce you to your host, Nathaniel Skula.
Well, I'm very privileged today to be joined by Mimi Harker. Hopefully I've got your name right there. OBE as well.
Indeed. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Yes.
Brilliant. So I'm very happy. And you're a community counsellor, a campaigner and a fundraiser. And I'm really, really interested to discuss with you. Well, we've got some great topics. We're going to talk about some great things. We're going to talk about fighting injustice, growing up in a man's world, being from Darjeeling and living in England and fighting against racism and prejudice and these kind of things, and you know how you've gone on to achieve success. And yeah, I'm really interested. Yeah, so
still striving for that success thing, but I have to say this should come with a warning, because I'm extremely frank. I don't mince my words, shall we say. I say what I think. So you know, I just say that as a warning. So take that on board if you want to listen to this.
I think that's great. I think that's really important. I like people who say exactly what they mean. That you don't need too much fluff these days. We don't have any time for all of that. So getting right into it, right? Tell me about like fighting injustice.
I think the whole desire to fight injustice really comes from this childhood of mine, where you if you're bullied quite a lot as a child, if you see a lot of injustice, and if you feel quite powerless to do anything about it, I think that's the key. All of those things certainly made me want to make sure that when I was grown up, I never ever allowed anyone to get away with bad behavior like that. So I will call it out anywhere, and I have got a bit of a reputation for calling out bad behavior. I think people call it being difficult, or being prickly, or perhaps saying things I shouldn't say, but it comes from the best of places. If I see somebody that's in trouble, I will step forward and I will step in and I will start to try to sort it out. I cannot help myself.
I think that's brilliant. And you're investigating some sort of crime wasn't there a murder you were just telling me about that happened a long, long time ago, and you're investigating that, but unfortunately the papers are closed, right? So you can't until 2030.
Correct. So it was a wonderful friend of mine who's an author. She wrote this amazing book about Ruth Ellis, and she wrote it in conjunction with Ruth Ellis's sister. The author is Monica Weller. And this book really got me thinking, because Monica is the sort of person that digs into things. And actually, you might enjoy talking to her as well one of these days.
Oh, lovely.
She'd be a great guest for you. But she's written this book. She's gone through everything like a hound dog. You know, she's really got in there. She's pulled it all out. And she's got this information, and she's put the facts together in a way that make it quite obvious that there is no way on earth that Ruth Ellis, who was the last woman who was hanged in this country back in 1955, there is no way that she could have pulled the trigger and murdered her lover. Hmm. And for that reason, and for that reason alone, because she was this, she was used. And the weird thing about Ruth is nobody associates her with the Profumo case, because she was 10 years before Profumo. And yet the same characters are involved. It was Dr. Stephen Ward that took Ruth basically from a background of poverty, you know, sent her to the hairdressers, had her groomed and coiffed and beautiful clothes and all the rest of it. And just got her ready for society life, as they would call it. And then gave her all these jobs to do. And she got involved in some really interesting circles, but they were all set up by Stephen Ward, who we all know was instrumental in the whole of the Profumo affair and what happened there. I mean, he was probably one of the most famous figures out of all of that, alongside Profumo and Christine Keeler.
So can you dig into that a little bit and explain a bit more about that? Because a lot of people are not going to know what you're talking about.
Is this the Profumo one or Ruth? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Profumo.
Yeah.
So that was just a big, big scandal involving John Profumo, who was very, very high level in the government, mm-hmm. and his affair with and Christine Keeler, that was it, because that wasn't my area of expertise, but it was Christine Keeler and Mandy Rice Davis were the two women who, they were just party girls they were young, they were had everything, you know, to live for, and they fell into the charms and the hands, if you like, of Dr. Stephen Ward, and they went out with very wealthy men, and they did lots of things for lots of gifts and cash as well, I believe. Yeah. And they were just party girls, good time girls, and it was going to bring the government down. And in fact, it did bring John Profumo down for sure, who until his dying day has been doing, you know, philanthropic stuff in the community ever since. He stepped down from politics. But that was 10 years after Ruth Ellis, and it was the same Stephen Ward who took these young girls and he groomed them and he got them out there. And it's really interesting, that connection. But the thing for me that bugs me about Ruth is that because she'd been ill from as a little girl, she'd had typhoid fever, her hand was withered. She hadn't, it was completely and utterly, it was just stunted where it was. So as a child, that's as big as it got. And she was a tiny, tiny little thing. She was tiny, skinny, really, really, really slim, tiny in stature. And there's no way, as they've shown in reconstructions, which they cannot seem to admit it, that it's taken a grown man two hands to pull the trigger off this wretched gun that she was supposed to have used. And there was no way that she could do it with just one hand, because the other hand was completely useless.
So the question is, why did that manage to get through? I mean, you know,
that's the question that we cannot find out, because as Monica will tell you when you interview her, she has tried to find those papers, but they're sealed until 2030. And that says to me that they're sealed until anybody to do with the case is gone.
Yeah. So what I mean, I've been watching this Epstein thing. Yeah. Yes. And I mean, yeah. I was absolutely horrified at this. Yeah. What the hell? Like, is the guy actually dead or did he just disappear? Like, has anyone seen the body? I mean, like, you know, I don't know. Yeah. Like he could, you know, I'm just throwing it out there. Yeah.
Like somebody else who disappeared many years ago after the nanny was found. Isn't that right? And disappeared and was never found again.
Yeah. I'm not sure. I'm not sure about what you're referring to there, but, I think it's a very strange situation. I think we're in a strange situation. It's a strange place. I mean, yeah. if anyone else, right, the normal individual who wasn't that wealthy, they would have gone to jail for 30 years.
Of course.
Or whatever, right? It's shocking.
Absolutely. It is shocking. And I think the one thing I will say about the times that we're in at the moment is that so many more people have become so much more familiar with technology and reaching out into the world. I think it's got its downside, of course it has, but the upside of that is people are going to become more inquisitive, people are going to become more adventurous, people are going to go and try and explore the world a bit more and see what else they can find out. And actually, it's quite easy to see the world from your armchair these days, isn't it? So that's rather good for you. So I think a lot of these things, I think a lot of people are going to be doing a lot of reading, and they're going to be digging and inquiring, because they're thinking like you, what happened? I need to know more.
Mm. But I think it'll be interesting if they do that when it comes to voting. Yeah. When it comes to, I mean, I think first of all, everyone should be made to vote. This is what should happen. They should be forced to vote. I don't care if you're in your armchair, you're at work, you need you know, we have the technology, we have the potential to use it. Yeah, but that's an absolute travesty, yeah?
Like, there's another conspiracy theory, isn't there, again?
It's voter apathy, which is actually caused by marketing. I mean, we know about it, certainly in Africa, in some of the countries out there.
I know.
Crazy.
I know. One big battle at a time, I think, and then eventually maybe the war. Who knows? Yeah. But it's just so, there are so many things that need to be tackled these days. That's the thing, isn't it? There's so much that needs to be done. I mean, look at the media for us, just to start off with. There was once upon a time when I believed everything I saw in the news. I couldn't imagine that you would read a newspaper that had a title and a name to it, and that you'd grown up with that newspaper's name ingrained into your, you know, into your mind, and you absolutely can't trust the word that any of them say anymore. That I find astonishing. That is my greatest sadness, that we have lost that trust and that we've lost that faith in those people who should be giving us the facts and the figures. They should be giving us the information, instead of which they've used their positions and their power and the position of influence, if you like, as a power rather than as an enabling tool. and they use it to put their own opinions out there and their own slant on things, rather than reporting fairly, accurately, and giving us what we need in order to make up our minds about what's actually going on. That, to me, is the greatest travesty of this life.
I'm pointing at you for people who are listening to this and not watching, because you just nailed it. Yeah. I mean, I spoke to Alistair Stewart. I interviewed him. He was one of my first guests. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think from where I'm sitting, we're wrapped up in political correctness. We're wrapped up in everything. Oh, I can't say that because it's going to hurt someone's feelings. It's like, look, in order for you to have a conversation, you need to perhaps hurt someone's feelings. So then they might change their opinion, and then we might actually all learn something, right?
Absolutely. And do something about it rather than just talking.
Yeah. But I, my business partner, Mike, I was talking to him earlier, and I said, look who I'm interviewing later. And he said, oh, I've got a question for her. Right. So he's old school. Mike is old school. Yeah. Okay. And he said, what do you think about the government's public opinion rating as a result of COVID? Is what he said. Mm-hmm. I know it's a painful question.
It is a painful question. And if you're, and I, as I promised you right at the start, I say it exactly as I see it. I was literally full of hope when I saw this new government come in. I was filled with hope. I was filled with I was fired up for the future. I was just thinking, wow, because the language that our Prime Minister uses is, it's intoxicating almost.
Yeah.
It's encouraging. It's full of that wonderful, rosy, you know, there's that future that's coming towards us. Let's all go walk towards it hand in hand sort of thing. And I was filled with optimism. COVID, I do not think the government has handled it very well at all. I don't think as a country we've handled it very well at all. I think we started our lockdowns, we started trying to contain it far too late. We relied on scientific evidence that the majority of us who read, you know, the news and watch the news, mm-hmm. and who take an interest, the majority of us know that an awful lot of what we were told and spoon-fed was based on modelling that hadn't been proven one way or the other. I think there's a lot of mistakes that were made. I know everything's wonderful with 2020 hindsight. However, there were other countries who were going through this. We could have taken a few leaves out of a few other books and learned a few lessons before we actually did what we did or didn't do what we should have done initially. Yeah. That's my thought on it. And I do think the government has got quite a big ladder to climb now to get back into that place where they were pre-COVID.
Yeah.
I think the country was just, on the whole, there was a great feeling of optimism. There was a great feeling of, wow, we've done the right thing here. We've finally got a decisive leader who's going to lead us down this path. You know, not one that's going to resign just because the election didn't go his way or the vote didn't go his way. You know, not somebody who came in and then was just bullied to death in the role that, you know, they were in and pushed this way and that. I just thought, yes. And I know a lot of people felt the same way.
If you actually look at the whole thing, right, all countries are like this. Yeah, they've all said, oh, well, we can do it better. We've got all these amazing PhDs. It's like, well, why didn't you just talk to people in Taiwan?
Absolutely. Share.
Let's get back to you, right? And let's go to growing up in a man's world. Yeah. You know, I mean, we might cross over into being from Darjeeling, but you know, please tell me what was it like? Like, to try and get somewhere in your career has been a big fight, yeah?
It's always been like swimming uphill in treacle. It's a really, I think, because I'm involved in the world of politics. I was very keen to play a part on the national stage, and I found out some very tough lessons very early on. And the biggest lesson I learned were there were an awful lot of women who didn't want other women who were good at what they were doing to be successful. And they wanted everything in their power to stop you from being there. That was the saddest lesson I learned. Because, and it was actually, and I mean, she's actually dead and gone now, bless her. But the woman who used to be in charge of the women's committee when I was first starting in all of this would actually ring up the associations where I had been given an interview for a parliamentary seat. And she would say to them, the thing with Mimi is she talks a good talk, but you don't want to be taking her on. She's a bit of a dolly bird because I like to, you know, I just enjoy, I've been taught from a very young age to present myself well. My mother was always immaculate. She is one of the most beautiful women. She's extremely proud of herself. She's very well groomed. She takes a great deal of pride in her appearance and how she presents herself to the world. And I picked up all of those things from my mum, who is, you know, absolutely, she was a role model for me growing up because she was immaculate. She could go anywhere and be with anybody and she just looked the part. She was a fabulous woman and is a fabulous woman. She just doesn't happen to be in the world of work anymore. She's retired and enjoying her garden. But that was my mum. When she was a working woman, she was out there, absolutely immaculate, went in, she was PA to sort of high-powered directors and local councils and blah, 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 and she was always very smart, never had chipped nail polish, and we didn't have gel nails in back in those days, so that was a big deal. And she was just wonderful and a great person to sort of copy. So I've always done the same. I've always wanted to be, if I'm going to do something, then I will present myself what I call properly. So everything I do is done properly. And other people don't see it that way. They see it as, I think they see it possibly as vanity and self-indulgence or something. They see it as an inability to be able to string two words together because you want to look presentable and appropriate. They see it as being, oh, the names really? I've been called over the years are incredible. Oh, yes. Featherbrain is one of them. So, do you know what? It doesn't actually bother me because I know what I do and I know what my track record is and I know what I'm perfectly capable of delivering. So that's absolutely fine because when people underestimate you, that's probably actually the greatest tool in your toolkit because it then gives you the ability to ask questions and to chat to people. And they think you're completely, you know, sort of, it's all, you know, tumbleweed over the top of you. And actually, you've just got all the information you need to build your case or whatever it is you happen to be working on. And off you go and you win your campaign. It's fabulous. So I don't mind people judging me by the way I look and behave. I've always been a smiley person. It could be my worst day and I will still be having this great big smile on my face because that's what makes me feel better. It's what gives me the power to get up and keep going. So that's me. Just keep smiling, keep sparkling. If your eyes aren't sparkling, you're not doing your job. It's that simple.
Well, I think, I think we're all our own media, aren't we? I mean, you know, it is what it is. And I grew a beard, right? I was smart until that point. Yeah. And I grew a beard, right? So what can I say? Yeah. I shaped it the other day.
I shaped
the beard.
Very nice too. Very nice too.
Oh, thank you.
Very neat.
Classic. So it must have been really, really hard, yeah, when you were growing up. Because, you know, I mean, I'm sort of in my 40s, right? And I remember being a lot younger, and you know, I used to live in Hazelmere or near Hazelmere in Surrey, right? I know you're from sort of Surbiton direction, but originally, yeah. And in those days, I mean, you know, if there was like an African or an Indian or a Pakistani or someone, you'd be like, whoa, like where, you know, what happened there? Like, like, is this guy going to rob my house?
How did they get
What's that?
Into our area?
What's that?
How exactly, did they get into exactly. our area?
Yeah. But it's still from? Like that, unfortunately, in a lot of rural areas in Devon. I mean, I lived in Devon for a while and it's definitely like that in some areas. I think it'll be great if these people from Hong Kong come to England. That will just blow these people. I mean, just think so about 2 million.
Imagine
2 million Hong Kong Chinese. Fantastic. Fantastic.
With their skills, their talents,
work ethic, their
intelligence, their entrepreneurship. Wow. That will bring the, you know, that will sort the COVID problem back.
It will sort out the work ethic.
It will. Exactly. Absolutely. That will completely wipe up whatever damage COVID's done. As soon as they come over, you know, we'll be back up again and running because they will bring all their magic with them. And they will because they're brilliant. I think it's a great move. I hope we facilitate it. I really, really do. I think it will be great for this country because it's bringing in people who've literally got, exactly as you said, the work ethic. They've got the intelligence, the dedication, the hard work, you know, sort of the skills, the whole ethic about wanting to learn and wanting to just create wonderful things and just go that little step further.
I like wonderful. Hong Kong. I went there a few years, about 12, 13 years ago on a trip around the world. And what I found was very interesting is when you approach the people in the street, if you're lost, you say, do you speak English? And the moment you say, do you speak English? Everyone I asked, I probably asked 20, 30 people, right? They all looked at you with a great amount of pride and they said, oh, yes, of course. How can I help you? And it was amazingly strange.
Absolutely. 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 No, it is a great, it's the whole culture, the whole ethic of it is brilliant. And I just think, yes, bring it on. Bring it on. I think it'd be great to have that fresh injection of, you know, sort of new ideas, innovation, forward thinking, new thinking.
And the language skills as well, right? I mean, because a lot of them are going to speak Mandarin as well.
Everybody should be judged by merit and by achievement and not by the skin colour. Not by your religion, not by your culture, not by any of those things. None of that is important. What is important is, can you do the job? Can you do what the task you've been given to do? Are you the best person for it? That's what should matter. Not if you're a man or if you're a woman. Yes, not if you're fat, if you're thin, not if you wear glasses or wear contact lenses or whatever, not if you look like the girl next door or the boy next door. None of that should make any difference whatsoever. It should be about, what can you do? Can you deliver the task that we're asking you to do? Are you the person for this job? Regardless of anything else, that's what it should be about. And that's what I hope this whole movement, motion, whatever you want to call it, around the whole world, I hope that's what it actually brings out in the end. If you're good for that job, you know, because I work with a lot of young people who are saying they're not given opportunities because of their age. If you've got a bright young person who presents themselves to you, my goodness me, snap them up, take them in, let them grow within your organization, your company, give them the tools they need to become, you know, the superstar that you've already seen in them, which is why you've asked them to join
But like, things have changed. Like in America is a lot. I mean, I know it's difficult in England and it's tough in the UK for ethnic minorities. From when we were growing up, it was a lot harder. I mean, my friend Josh, he grew up north, up in like Leeds, And he used to have a fight all the time. Like, people just have a fight with him just because he was Indian. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. But there was another thing you've just touched on. People used to fight with people because they came from up north.
Yeah, well, we still... Northerners. No, but we do it for a laugh now, you know.
Yeah, no, it's love. Oh, they're north of Watford Gap.
We have a good scrap with the Northerners. You know, there's always this. There's always this thing, but it's not the same as... It's not the same, is it? As, I mean, I remember going to school and we had this guy called Gary, And he was from up north. And, you know, we were in this posh school when I was a kid. And I remember everyone taking the mickey out of Gary and they'd go, hey, oh, here comes Gary.
It happens. Yeah, it happens. See, my husband's from up north, so I've heard it. He's from Hartlepool, so he used to get, a monkey hanger. You know, it happens. But he takes it on the chin. He's fine with it. He'll find something to say back to that person. He'll have a listen to where they come from and he'll find something.
But it's not the same. It's not the same as like ingrained racism within society. Like, it's a different thing. Correct. Like there are levels of bullying, right? And there's a sense of humour, which is very alien to a lot of people around the world. The British sense of humour is quite strange to many, right? But like when you went to boarding school, over in Darjeeling, right?
Oh,
so what? Dear. What sort of happened? Like, how?
I had reverse racism there, by the way, because of course I had an English accent, and there I was at the boarding school, and also in schools in those days. I don't know if it's the same today because I haven't investigated it, to be honest. But in those days, it used to be not according to your age, the class that you were put in. It was according to your ability. So I was 7 years old, and I was in the class with the 9 and 10 year olds. Which was quite interesting because I was always tiny. I mean, the only difference between me as an adult and me as a child is when I was a child, I was skinny. And so I was this puny, skinny, shy, short-sighted child. Yes, and I was very, very quiet, very shy, very painfully shy. So and I just couldn't stand up for myself. So I did find myself going through a lifetime of being picked on, bullied. People used to love pulling my glasses off my face and chucking them at each other and poking fun when I couldn't see well because I was really short-sighted. And they used to find it was like a game. It was very amusing to watch me sort of, you know, to throw my glasses and then to tell me which direction they'd thrown them in and then to watch me trying to find them. In the end, actually, I stopped looking for my glasses. I'd wait, I'd just stand there until they got bored and went away, and then I'd go and try and find them. But those are the lessons you learn quite, you know, as a child, that you learn the hard way. Going to school, but when I came back to this country after boarding school, you know, I was never accepted in India because I had an English accent. So they saw me as somebody who was had grown up in a white country and who'd adopted white behavior and mannerisms and the language skills, if that's the way to put it. So I didn't fit in for that reason. Over there, and over here I don't fit in because of the brown skin, and people will say to you, oh, don't be so ridiculous. I've had comments like, oh, for goodness sake, get those chips off your shoulder, woman. Yes, and people physically that to you. If I don't like injustice, I've never liked it. So somebody will say to me in a meeting, they'll point the hand at me and they'll say, these people come over here and whatever the thing is, and I've stood up, because as I've said, I will call it out. And I've stood up and said, are you talking to me? Would you like to explain to me what I've come over here and done that's causing me so much grief? Yeah. And again, when you do that, it's not that you're, you know, you're not seen as someone that's pointing out an issue that needs to be addressed, or pointing out an issue where someone needs to be a bit mindful, perhaps, about the way they phrase things.
Yeah.
Okay. You're being called out for being a troublemaker, for being up for upsetting people, for why did you have to say that? Why couldn't you just let it go? Why should I let it go? Because it's just caused all this trouble and it's upset everybody. And nobody knows how to handle this now. Well, go and get the HR director and they'll tell you how to handle it. You know, but it's that sort of thing. I've got so many incidents where I could just say to you that I've stepped forward and said, no, this is not acceptable. And I've been told I'm either playing the race card or I'm being very chippy, or I'm being an Asian woman, stop it. Ooh. Or I'm being a victim. Yes, and I'm none of those things. Believe me, spend half an hour with me face to face, you'll know that I am none of those things, but I will call it out every single time.
I think more people should do that, because otherwise people don't understand that, because they're all programmed with this behavior that they're like, oh, well, that's just how it's always been done. It's like, well, just because it's always been done like that doesn't mean you need to carry on with it. Yeah, you need to change, right?
But you do need to change. But I have to say, from my own experiences, it doesn't get you anywhere. Because especially if you're the only one that's calling it out and nobody stands beside you or even slightly behind you. If you are the only one, and I can tell you it has often been the case that I am the only one, then you end up actually doing more. It's a terrible, terrible, it's a terrible dilemma when you're in that position, because you're sort of thinking to yourself, right, I need to call this out, but if I do, this is going to happen. I've got to that stage in my life now where everything that I wanted to happen never happened because of me being big mouth, as I call myself, and calling things out. So, okay, all of that's gone. Being a member of parliament, that's never going to happen for me now. I've upset far too many people, you know. Well, I have. And it's because I call things out in the nicest possible way. I am not a nasty person. I'm not a vicious person. I'm not a cruel or unkind person. But if something's wrong, I absolutely have to say it. And I'm afraid that doesn't go down very well. So parliamentary career, gone. Anything else I wanted to do in politics, pretty much gone. I don't know. I don't know why it's so difficult to actually take situations and say, do you know what? She knows what she's talking about. And what she's got to say is actually the way the majority of people feel. People want to do the right thing in general, but sometimes you don't know what that right thing is. A few years ago, I went on a political trip to Israel. I was literally bowled over. I thought it was fabulous. I thought the country, it's young, it's vibrant, it's fresh. It's, you know, everybody's keen. Everybody wants to make something wonderful happen. And I thought, you know, just being there just made every sort of sinew in my body just come alive and just think, wow, this is energizing. This is great. And then I was taken to Yad Vashem for one of our trips to have a look around the Holocaust Museum there. And within a few minutes of going through that door, oh, even just talking about it now, it was literally heartbreaking. It was literally heartbreaking. You cannot imagine that one human being could do that to another human being. Oh, I'm really sorry about this. It made me a bit teary. It was absolutely horrific. And I turned around to the woman who was doing the tour and I just said to her, do you honestly think anything has changed? And she looked at me and she said, what do you mean? And I said, surely, I said, what you can see is that nothing has actually changed, or not an awful lot has changed. Some things have changed, of course they are. You know, we've now got brown people in politics. We've got brown people, you know, as MPs and stuff. But nothing has changed. I said, you know, nothing much has, because what you see now is people covering up those feelings that they have under this thin veneer of civility and education. And if that were not the truth, we wouldn't be seeing the situations that we see today. We wouldn't be talking about racism now if that were not the case. We wouldn't be talking about cultural differences if people truly had changed and were truly there and didn't think about these things. Therefore, how are we not seeing it in your face? And it's because people hide behind, I believe, that veneer of education and civility. But those of us who are on the front line and on the delivery side of some of that stuff, we know it's there. We know it's out there. We know it's there. And it's a question of how do you deal with it? I think you've caught me at a time in my life where I have decided I have got absolutely nothing to lose anymore. Therefore, that brings with it the greatest of freedom. I don't have to worry about upsetting people or not upsetting people, or offending people or not offending people. I can say what I think and I believe, and I can back it up with fact. I can back it up from experience, and I'm not frightened to speak out anymore. And I think that's one of the most liberating processes I have gone through in the last few months. And I really have, and it's a completely new freedom. And I find myself in the same forums where I used to sit there and think, oh, I better not say anything because they won't understand what I'm saying, and they'll just pick on me, and they'll just say, oh, well, we don't want Mimi in that job because she'll just be difficult or troublesome or whatever. Actually, now I don't care. If you want the job doing by somebody who knows what they're doing, and you want it done properly, and you really want to get to this, you know, you really mean it when you say, I want to deal with racism. I'll take that as an example, because that's what we've been talking about. Let's take her. Let's ask her. Let's learn from her. Let's find out what really happens. Let her get a group of people that she knows who've also been victims or who've also suffered from these things. And let's talk to them and find out what it is that we haven't seen. What is it that we haven't understood? And how can we change things? How can we be more considerate? How can we be more understanding? Because with understanding and knowledge comes tolerance. It is with ignorance that you have this appalling behavior. If you don't understand something, it's frightening. It's part of human DNA. And therefore, you put the barriers up, the shields up, you put the defenses up, and you try and protect what you think you're supposed to be protecting. Knowledge is empowering and it's enabling. And that's the way I see it. And I think now I've got to that stage in my life, all my dreams have gone. They ain't happening. I've offended and upset too many people. It's not coming out for me. It's just not happening. And people actually don't like people that talk as straight as I do, I'm afraid. I'm very forthright. I say it like it is. It doesn't go down well.
I think it depends on where you are. I mean, like, you know, really? I have very straight talking people around me. I much prefer that. I'm not into all of the sort of fluff. We'll talk around the subject. It's like, well, why don't you just say it as it is and just get it out there? Yeah. You know, and...
Mm-hmm. True, but as my husband would say to me, he's from the northeast of England, he's white, he's working class, and he said, if I said half the stuff you said, I'd be in jail.
Of course. Yeah, because he's white and he's male. Yeah,
and he's male, and you know, and he's northern.
He can't help that, sorry. Mr. Harker, I'm sorry.
As he said to me, if I said half the stuff that you say, Mimi, I would be in trouble for it, because, and I always say it as well, by the way, and it almost feels like you're doing, it's an apology. I can say this because I've got a permanent suntan. Well, okay. Is that really what I should be saying anymore?
That's a good point.
There's a question for you. Should I be saying anymore? But I do say it, and I do try and qualify statements with, look, I'm just going to say it, and please forgive me, I'm qualified to say it because I wear this. Yeah.
But so...
But you shouldn't have to say that. I don't. I mean, the first time I said it, and I realised it was actually quite a powerful thing to be able to say. And it's made me, it's like with anything. The first time you sort of say no to something after being a yes person all your life, it feels really scary. I just said no to that. Oh my goodness, they're going to hate me forever now. No, they don't actually. They understand that you've got a lot on your plate and you can't possibly do any more.
Well, it's good to say no. I mean, that's the, it's really good because you know, that's what makes success, right? It's about what you say no to, not what you say yes to. Yeah. And, but I think, all of what you've told me, right, and all I've understood about you as a person, it's you've built such determination and persistence that whatever you're going to go on to do is just going to be, it's going to be huge. It's going to be exciting. Yeah, I think. Well, why wouldn't it be?
I hope so. I feel, you just sort of lit that fire in me again to speak with passion on something.
You need to do a TED talk.
I don't know what it is about me, but. Oh, I need to do something that really grabs my imagination, that really takes my passion and my energy and my enthusiasm. I need something that I can pour all of that into and make something happen. I really do. I was inspired enormously as a young person by Mother Teresa. She was one of the most, I've had the privilege and the pleasure of knowing her over a 2.5 year period. And we didn't talk very often because she was a very busy lady, but we did, the times we did speak, she was a woman of such calm and strength. She was tiny and amazing. And when I was only 18 when I met her, and I'd already spent a life in service, as I call it, because I love doing things for people. I love volunteering. I just like making people smile. And I've always been like that. And it makes me happy when I've done something for somebody and it makes their day. It really makes me happy. And as I say, it's always been a part of me to be that way. And with Mother Teresa, one of the things that she said to me was, because she was going through a terrible time at the time, she'd been given a gift of a whole load of, it was a gift of medication or something. She couldn't use it because she had an orphanage, you know, and she had sick people, but she couldn't do anything with what she'd been given because it wasn't suitable. So it was all stashed away somewhere because, you know, no use for it. And she got accused of all sorts of things because of that. And including selling it off and using the money. And, you know, you could see from her very simple lifestyle, she was really living the high life somewhere, wasn't she? Not. You know, her life was completely dedicated to the people of Calcutta and to children. And just as she, I mean, a saint, yes, absolutely. And she said to me, and I said, I don't know, well, I said to her, I don't understand how you can be so strong and so calm when they're literally at the gates of your house now, trying to get a story from you about what they think you've done when you haven't. And she said, child, she said, when you have a goal, you must always focus on that goal. And people will try and pull you off the path. But if you believe in something, you just follow that path and you reach your goal. And don't let anybody distract you. And she said, I remember she just touched my shoulder and she said, there will come a time when you will remember those words and you will learn. You will realize how right I am. She said, just focus on what you want to do and just do it. And don't let people pull you away from that path. And that's how I've spent all my life. Just focusing on what I want to achieve. Why do I want to do it? Examine in yourself. Is it for self-aggrandizement or is it for service? And I've always been service. I've always been there. I mean, in the role that I have now, I'm there for my community. My family absolutely come first. But after that, it's definitely community. And it's the vulnerable people in my community who will get as much of my time as they need and I can give them. It's the most rewarding, the most fulfilling work. It is amazing. I just wish I could stop this, I don't know, this feeling in me that says I've got to keep pushing forward and keep pushing on and keep wanting to make things happen. I don't know what else I want to make happen, but I know that there is something else I need to make happen. I just don't know what it is yet. And, I hope so. I hope so. I hope I've got another 20 years of fighting battles and making things happen, but there is something, I know there is an unfulfilled mission that is yet to be discovered.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. And all these things that I'm going through in life are all part of that journey to strengthen me up so that I'm ready when the time comes to take on this big, whatever it is. That's what it is. And I just feel, yes, something is waiting for me. I'm building up to it. All this other stuff. I mean, my grandma used to say the same thing as I hear here every all the time. You know, my grandma always used to say, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger. And she should know. She came from, she was on the wrong side of partition. She was married off to the younger of two brothers who were tea planters. And from that, she made the most amazing, amazing, amazing success of her life. She went from riches to rags and then back to, you know, semi-riches again. And she never once ever in her life forgot about the poor people. She never once. When she died, the queue to pay their respects to her was around the block several thousand times, I can tell you. The people that just didn't know what they wanted to do. I always used to ask the question, why does she live in this humble little flat? Why doesn't she live in the same sort of apartments that her friends all live in, with marble floors and chandeliers and, you know, oodles of space and oodles of servants and air conditioning in every room? And it was when she died that the answer came out. It's because all her money was spent on poor people. She educated families on the streets. She educated their children. And if they had, then they didn't like it because they wanted their children to be working. And she would say, well, let me educate two of your children and soon they'll be working and they'll be keeping you because they'll have the education to get the good jobs. And she persuaded some families to allow her to do that. She educated young people. She made sure that they achieved this. You know, in India, people know you have servants in where you used to. I don't know if you still do anymore. I haven't been back for a very long time. In fact, since she died over 10 years ago, I've never been back since. It's never felt the same without her. And I don't want to go back without her. It's a funny feeling. But you always had servants in the house. All the servants in our houses grew up, were educated. They're not servants. It used to be that servants became servants, for generation after generation. And as a family, we didn't let that happen. We made sure that all the kids in all the villages were educated. We made sure up until the age of 14, and after that we had no, you know, it had to be down to the families. But that's what the family legacy really is. It's that education. And for example, one of the young ladies that I grew up with, who was a servant in our house, she was a friend to me. She was older than me, but I always saw her as a friend because she was always there when I needed, you know, anyone to talk to or whatever. When she had her child, even though she was always a servant, and I was shocked when I found out that what she slept on was a rolled up sort of mattressy thing. And I thought, wow, she doesn't even have a bed. However, her daughter has a degree in psychology and her daughter is, you know, is working in an office or in a clinic, earning loads of money. That child is never, ever going to be a servant and none of her children are going to. Do you see what I mean? So it's that education. It's that thinking. It's that enabling. It's wanting to change things. It's wanting to make the world a better place. It's wanting to do the right thing for people.
100%. We'll have another conversation one of these days. My grandfather did a lot of stuff in America when he had his factory out there in New York. He started with nothing, started with nothing at the age of 15, put himself through MIT, started a factory from like a scrap metal business that he started to start with, you know. And it's like, my attitude is people have just got to get on with it. They've just got to start somewhere and get on with it. And, you know, and I think your purpose changes during your life. I think, you know, I've got a big thing about getting ready for the opportunity. Like what you were just saying, you're basically getting ready for something. You don't know what it is, but everything you're doing, but it will come when you, I think you just need to relax. And it will literally just go and arrive because I think that's what happens. That's what happens. Right. And I think right now, I think it's a brilliant time because you know, China and the way that they've dealt with the world isn't looked upon favorably anymore. So what's happening is that power is actually moving to India now. And a lot of technology businesses are launching companies. Today there was a company announcement that Google have invested in, and a few other companies invested in some sort of virtual reality, augmented reality glasses, right, for some application or other. And I think the opportunities in India are massive for this sort of thing, really. So it's exciting.
I think it is exciting. I have a challenge for you, actually. I want your help with something. So this is the 12A cinema classification. Okay. So let me tell you a little bit about it. So I am responsible for it, but I cannot get Wikipedia to credit me with it, which every time I change it on Wikipedia, somebody changes it back. And that really makes me cross, because how this happened, and this is the story. So it's the very first Spider-Man movie in the early noughties. Okay. So my little boy was probably about 4 or 5 at the time. And he wanted to go and see this, or he might be, it was about five or six at the time. And he wanted to go and see Spider-Man, who was his hero. So he had, you know what it's like with kids and movies when they come out? We'd been bombarded with all the media and the advertising and everything else. And back in the noughties, we didn't have the technology we have today, but it still got to us, you know. So he had the toys and the, you know, the Spider-Mobile, and he had the head spider helicopter, and he had everything. He had the pajamas. I remember going into Woolworths and buying a pair of red Wellington boots and getting a black marker pen and painting webs on. So that they matched his little outfit. Now you go and buy an outfit and it's got muscles built into it. In those days, it was just flimsy fabric with Spider-Man stuff all printed over the top, okay? So he had all of that, and his babysitter, knowing his passion, painted full size on his wall, Spider-Man just bursting through the wall, okay? So this boy was passionate about Spider-Man, his duvet, his lampshade. He went to sleep with Spider-Man hanging down from over the ceiling, yes? And in his, literally in his face. And when the movie came out, it was a 12. So I'm 5'1". So even sitting on my shoulders with a long coat over the top, there's no way he was going to get in.
Okay.
Yeah, with that baby face. So he was going to miss out on this film. And he was absolutely heartbroken. So I went to see it. And there was nothing in it that made me feel that he couldn't go in and see that. So I started a campaign. And I stood outside our local cinemas in Wickham, in Gerrards Cross and in Chesham. And I stood there with a questionnaire for people who'd been in to see any sort of viewings of them. And I asked them to fill them in. One person didn't like it. And that was a granddad. And he said, no, I wouldn't let my grandchild see that. Everybody else was really happy with it. So in those days, I was very newly elected then as well. I'd only been in the job probably about one term of office. So it might have been coming up with my first term of office. And what you do is you have, as a member, you might do all this work. And I did all the questionnaires, got it, all the information. You give it to an officer. And the officer was this wonderful officer called Karen Brimacombe, who, the last I heard of her, she's working in a council on the South Coast. And she sent it all off for me to the British Film Board, who a few weeks later came back and said, we've had a look at your findings and we find that we agree with you. Therefore, we are creating the 12A classification. Now, what this means is that we might still think that there are some scenes in there that may be violent or whatever, so only somebody from 12 and upward should go and see it on their own. But the A is for adult, so somebody under the age of 12 can go and see it with an adult.
You're asking me to mess about with Wikipedia for you.
No, I'm asking you to find out how I can get that
someone
justice
else needs to do
that
it for
injustice.
You. I can't. Someone needs to do it. Yeah.
They did, but that was my campaign. And if you look at it on Wikipedia, it says from pressure.
Why
from
don't you write a blog about it and put it on your site, and then someone will do it for you, probably. Yeah,
you reckon?
But well done.
I want
well done.
I want that because I could tell you there isn't a single family in this country who has not benefited from having that 12A classification. And that was my first big
national
success.
I haven't done anything like that. So. What advice have you got for people who are listening to this, who may be bullied or they feel like down, like just to finish on a real positive note, what have you got?
Absolutely. So when you're bullied, it does make you think, oh, I'm not worthwhile. I'm not worthy. There's something about me. Why do they pick on me? Actually, it's not that at all. It's that thing that I was saying before. It's ignorance. They don't know you. They don't understand you. They don't understand where you come from. And that's your strength, because you do know you and you do know your culture and you do know what you stand for. So you have to believe in yourself. You have to say to yourself, and it's got to be a pull yourself up by your own sort of.
I am sitting up straight now. Come on, then.
Absolutely. You've got to do it. Absolutely. You've got to do it yourself. And you've got to say to yourself, what is it? This is what, you know, exactly what Mother Teresa said to me. What is your goal? What is it you want to achieve? What is stopping you achieving it? Is it because you're listening to other people, or is it because you're basically not looking at what you've got to offer? Don't listen to other people. Look at what is within yourself And when you've looked at what is within yourself, know that what you're doing is good. And in knowing that what you're doing is good, get on with it. And actually, if I hadn't said that to myself, I would have given up politics back in 2004, when that first woman started ringing around and saying to people, don't have her. She's all powder and paint and no substance. She talks a good talk, but she's got nothing else going for her. Bless you. Well, I really appreciate this, the opportunity to chat to you about all of this. I think that's probably the first time I've spoken with the new shell that's been taken off and the new Mimi that's emerged. You know, I'm over it. It was heartbreaking at one point. Oh my goodness, I'm never going to achieve my dreams. And all these wonderful young, and there are some amazing young women who are coming up in, you know, behind me, who have been encouraged by things that I've said, by seeing me speak in places, by thinking to themselves, if she can do it, I can do it. I want to do what she's doing. And that to me is probably the greatest solace, yeah, if there is one. But for me, it's over as far as that dream is concerned. And therefore, I now speak my mind, because I don't have to worry about any repercussions anymore. And that is so empowering. And I love it.
Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks for listening to Positive Personal Power. Do subscribe via your favorite podcasting app and please leave us a 5-star review. Or sign up on our website, positivepersonalpower.net, for weekly emails and updates, and do share our episodes with your friends and on social media. Feel free to reach out anytime.